The Secrets of Technology is brought to you by the StarQuest Production Network and is made possible by our many generous patrons. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit sqpn.com/give. Hi, I'm Dom Bettinelli, and you're listening to The Secrets of Technology, where we discuss the technology news that's important to you from a uniquely Catholic point of view. And join me today on the panel is Joanne Mercier. Hey, Joanne.
Hey, Dom.
Before we get into today's show, I want to tell everyone about another show on the StarQuest Network they're sure to enjoy called Let's Science. It's very compatible with this show. You can find that wherever fine podcasts are found or at sqpn.com/science. And it's a fun look at a science topic every other week in about 20 minutes or so. It's a nice little show, and you'll really enjoy it, especially with your kids. I think that it's really kid friendly. So definitely check that out. So we're kind of vamping a little bit this week. Our usual panel, Father. So tonight is supposed to be Father Andrew and Pat. Father Andrew is away, and Pat was with us, and then she had to. She's having computer problems. It's ironic. This show. of all the shows in the network has the most computer problems, which maybe is not it may be a little understandable given that we're all on this show techies who are doing weird things to our computers. So maybe that
makes exactly. Joanne, so I'm it.
Yes. Joanne has graciously jumped in at the last minute so that I'm not sitting here by myself chatting with all of you. I have someone to talk to. Our first segment is going to be on various email tools. This segment will be mostly me because, like I said, Joanne hasn't had time to really prepare the segment. So let's just jump right into it. And what we were going to talk about is tools to help you with your email. They're not email clients per se, like Apple Mail or Outlook or that sort of thing. We've talked about those before, but these are tools to help with your email. And this is not a comprehensive look. We're going to just look at a couple of different ones that I'm familiar with and how they might help you with your email. And most of them are cross platform. There's one or two of them that are, single platform only or single tech company only. But most of them are work across platforms. And the first one I want to talk about is kind of near and dear to my heart because, it's actually a new app that's not quite out yet. I know it's kind of weird for me to talk about an app that's not out yet, but, it's based on mail plugins that used to work on Apple Mail. I should let you know, Apple Mail used to have a structure where people, developers could add functionality to Apple Mail through plugins. They had a plugin structure. Apple got rid of that as a security thing. I don't love that idea. I kind of wish that they didn't do that. On the other hand, every time Mail got updated with an operating system, it broke all the extensions and then you had to wait for the developers to fix them all. And that's why I ended up stopped using a lot of them, over time, because it just was, it was too much of a pain. And I just wanted to use the Mail client as it was, but Maven had, used to be called Mail Suite, and it had these, plugins in the suite called Mail Acton and Mail Tags. They had other ones as well, but these were really good. Mail Acton was really nice because, and so Mail Maven looks like Apple Mail. And we'll have all this functionality built into it. And one of the Mail Acton functionality is you can use various key combinations to do things. And then you also have rules, not just incoming mail rules, which is what Apple Mail already has, but you can create outgoing mail rules so that when you send an email, it does a thing and you could do various things with it. There's also mail tags where you can tag your mail. So you can have mail across accounts that may relate to a particular project or an area of your life. And you can tag them and then using search functionality and smart search and all that sort of stuff, bring all those together. So like when you file a mail in a folder, it can only be in one folder at a time. That's one of the things nice things with Gmail is you can have multiple labels, but with folders, you can only be one folder. But with a tag or label, you can have it in multiple places. So, and it looks like as I was looking through the site for Mail Maven, they're adding a lot more. There's so much that's in there. Delayed delivery, scheduled messages, templates and signatures and message encryption and all that sort of thing. Once this comes out, I'm actually going to give it a pretty good look, because it looks like it works a lot like Apple Mail, but with all this extra functionality, it may be worthwhile checking this out. So Mail Maven, and that's at mailmaven.app, and you can, you know, click in there and ask to be notified once it's available. So that should be pretty interesting.
So Dom, what this type of a mail tool will do is help you to organize then your mail. For example, I have two or three, actually four different emails for work. Mm-hmm. And they're, you know, each one is for a specific thing. A tool like this would help me bring them all together, at least with tags, so that I could find what I'm looking for. Or,
yeah, it'll help you keep track of it. So it's a mail client, but it will help you keep track of mail in the various places, organize them, tag them, and take action on them. Of various ways. This, like, I have to send out emails, like at the beginning of every month, I have to email folks who've made pledges to our Patreon, patreon.com/StarQuest. They've had a decline on their credit card, like maybe their card's expired or something like that. And so I usually email folks and just let them know. And hey, you know, here's a link to an explanation on the Patreon site. And I have to like create emails for each individual person. And Mail Acton would help me do that with a touch of a button. You know, I could mail merge it in, whereas now I have to do it all manually, one at a time. It would be, you know, nice to have a tool that does that sort of thing. And it's, so this is a mail client that replaces Apple Mail, instead of working inside Apple Mail like the old Mail Suite used to do. So,
okay.
Yeah. So that's one I thought was very interesting off the top. It's not one you can use today, but it's one off the top. Another one that I use now, it's not a plugin. It's an outside service. I've used this, gosh, for maybe 10 years now. I mean, I've been a paying user for Sanebox at sanebox.com at least a decade, maybe more. Cause I think when I worked for the Archdiocese of Boston, which is more than a decade ago now, I had it there. So what this does is, it connects to your, either you can use a Google account, an Office 365 account, or iCloud, and it connects to your accounts, and it watches your mail as it comes in, and it creates a set of folders. And there are some basic folders, and you can create a limited number of other folders as well. And you train it. And so you have, you train it on this kind of email should go into this folder. So for example, let me just use my email as an example, my email inbox. I have a, so it's sane box is what it's called. So I have a sane later mailbox, and I have a sane news mailbox, and I have a bunch of others. I don't want to have to explain them all because it's sort of very specific to the way I work, but there's like a sane bulk box and a sane black hole. Those are the important ones. So when you start using it, you have to train it. And so as things come in, you can train it however you like. I use sane later as mail that I want that. So all the important mail goes to my inbox. Then the second level mail is important mail that needs to be dealt with, during the day or over the next day or so. That goes into sane later, and sane news is the folder or Gmail label where that has all of my newsletters, all the advertising stuff that I actually want, but is not important. And then sane black hole might be one of my favorites, because that's where persistent spam that I can't stop and that spam filters aren't like. I once subscribed to a newsletter for a particular famous Boston athlete who had his own wellness company, and I was curious and subscribed, and I can never make them stop sending them, and for some reason they always get through Gmail's junk mail folders filters. So I took that mail, put it in sane black hole, and from now on Sanebox moves that the emails from that company always to the black to delete it. And so what happens is as you train it, and it doesn't take very long, it's a few days to start training where things should go. And now it just files everything for me. And it's been doing it for so long, and it puts things, you know, in the right places for me. It's like having an assistant who's organizing my mail, for me. And so my inbox is almost always empty. I have like one email in it right now, which.
That one looks great. Yes. That I could use for work, I'll tell you.
And I have two separate accounts for that, for one for my personal and one for my work. And it's $99 a year, the basic, or you can get 2 years worth, in which gives you 9 free months. So if you pay bi-yearly, they give you nine. It's $169. So in other words, it's $12 a month for the two. If you use it for two email accounts, it's $7 a month if you just want one email account. But you also get at the higher levels, you get more features, more folders and that sort of stuff. So you have to kind of look at that. Even if you have one email account, you may want the middle tier to get the extra features, which I think are pretty darn good to get. Like I said, I've been using this for a decade and been happily paying it for, 10 years or more. I think it's at least 10 years. It is fantastic. I've never regretted having it. So another one that I have experience with, and that one, and like I said, with that one, with Samebox, by the way, like I said, it's cross-platform. It has nothing to do with the platform you're on. It all has to do with what email service you're using. And so that's, like I said, if you have a Google account, whether it's a Google for domains, like a private domain, like sqpn.com, or a Gmail, you can use it either, you can use iCloud, or you can use it with Microsoft 365 as well, which a lot of people do have a 365 account. So the next one we're talking about that I have some experience with is called Mail Butler. And I tried this out for a while. I didn't find I was using all of its features, so I didn't keep using it, but it's a nice tool. So this one works with your Apple Mail, iCloud, Gmail, and Outlook. Again, just like with the Sanebox, it works across platform, macOS, Gmail, and Outlook. And it does a few more things. It does some email tracking, so it tracks when your emails were opened and your links were clicked. I don't love that as someone who prefers privacy. I don't like necessarily inflicting that on other people, putting things in my emails. It does have a smart send later, so you can schedule your emails to send at specific times. There's an interesting strategy sometimes when you want to make sure that you're at the top of someone's inbox when they get in the morning. You can schedule to send at, say, 6:30 in the morning their time, that sort of thing, so that that when they open their inbox, then you're the first email, that sort of stuff. There's some strategies with that. Email signatures, which, I find email signatures to be anything more than just a couple lines to be obnoxious anyway, so it's not really interesting to me. There's a task system built in. Some people would like to use their mail client as their to-do list. That's a valid way to do it. I don't do that, but some people do. Email templates and contacts and snoozing mails. That's one of the things with Sanebox, by the way. They also have a snoozing system. If I forward an email to say at Sane, it's a Sane Tomorrow at Sanebox.com, it will resurface that email in my inbox the next day, that sort of thing. And so Mail Butler has some things like that as well. So it also has tags and a new AI-powered email assistant that can write your emails. You're going to see a lot of that. There's a lot of that going on these days, getting assistance in using AI to help you write emails. I'm old school on that still. I'm not sure how I feel about that. Another tool that's out there, I don't have experience with this one per se, but I've heard enough about it, I think you should mention it, which is Grammarly. Grammarly, it works as an extension in your browser. So it will work with any web-based, email system like Gmail or Google Mail or anything like that. I do think that you can also, they might also have a standalone. I think they have a desktop standalone and a mobile versions as well. And this one just checks your grammar. You know, what's your, you know, is your grammar correct? Is it, and it also, you know, grades it sort of on grade level. Is it what, you know, how complex is your grammar? Is it legible, readable? I don't love grammar checkers. I'm pretty good at, like, I know I make, you know, spelling mistakes and typos and that sort of stuff. I just don't love it when they want to rewrite what I have to say. I always find it that the grammar checkers tend to strip the voice and the personality out of my writing. Maybe it should.
my take on it would be, because I have to write for a specific type of audience, like church.
Yep.
Would it be able to continue my voice and not strip it and just, you know, be more like marketing? That I'd be worried about. But it looks interesting enough, I might give it a try.
Yeah. They do claim to learn your voice. So, I mean, maybe that's worthwhile. You know, again, they talk about, like, they've got this AI thing that learns your style and tone and voice and emulates it. So the only time I've ever used a Grammarly product was when we used Hootsuite, which is a social media manager. I was using that for SQPN. I've actually since switched away from Hootsuite, just as an aside, because they recently increased their prices dramatically, and I moved to Social Pilot, which has been pretty good so far.
Now, I might take this one for a spin to see what it does, because sometimes I do sit there for like 20 minutes going, how am I going to rephrase this? I could probably use a little AI help.
Sometimes it's nice to even to just get a different version to look at, just to, like, I may not use it, but it, like, sometimes I'll do that with ChatGPT. I'll just throw something there, like, rewrite this with a different tone, you know, just rewrite this, punch it up, make it better. Imagine you're an editor, or, you know what I mean? Sometimes you have to do that. We have to you kind of make it hallucinate. Imagine you are an editor. Like, we'll do some role playing. And, you know, rewrite this, and I'll look at it and go, that's stupid, but it gives me an idea, and that's probably the best use of it. Now, another email client that is supposed to be pretty good, I haven't tried it yet, but it is supposed to be, it's cross-platform. Newton works on iOS, Android, Mac, and Windows, and Chrome OS. So it's cross-platform, works everywhere, and it's supposed to have a ton of features, like I've talked about before. It'll do read receipts, so, you know, tell you when people have opened your emails. Again, I don't like that sort of, it feels invasive to kind of make people tell you when they've opened your emails. But some people want that, so that's fine.
I have that on a system called Flocknote. Mm-hmm. And for notes like that to your community, yeah, okay, fine. But regular ones, I don't think I could, you know. Yeah. Somebody wants to ghost me, fine.
Yeah, it has to be for very specific uses, like you say. Like, sometimes they're important internal communications, like to a ministry group in the parish where people have to get things done. I want to make sure everybody gets my message. But when it's just emails to random people, you gotta be careful with that. But it has some other, like, AI kind of features, like something called Recap that resurfaces unresolved conversations. That's a nice little feature that you can find sometimes in certain of these products, where I think Sanebox will do that too, where it'll say, hey, by the way, you emailed this person with a question 3 days ago. Do you want to follow up? So there's that sort of thing, which is a nice assistant there. The other thing that some of these will do, like Newton does, is it will connect to other apps to let you move, you know, emails between, say you use Todoist or OneNote or Trello as your to-do list or your project management. You can move emails in between them very easily. It's built in to the system, so that's really nice. Snoozing emails, like, you know what, I need to deal with this email, but not today. Snooze it till tomorrow or for 3 days, and then it will take it out of your inbox. What's not there bugging you every time you look at your inbox, and it brings it back to you in 3 days. So that's really nice. You know, send later, that sort of stuff. So It's got a lot of those nice features like that in it for you. And then one last one I want to mention. Pat was going to bring this up, so hopefully I can do this justice for. It's called Gmail Notes, and the way this works is it works inside the web browser with your Gmail, and it lets you take notes on emails, as you know. So it pops up a little window there, so that when you're working in an email and you need to remember something, you want to take notes on it, you want to annotate, you want to, you know, get the important information out of it, you can use this to take notes in the browser window. And it works across platforms, and will work even on mobile. I'm pretty sure it's on mobile. So
I'm looking at something like that going, wouldn't it just be better if you just take the note, and for me anyway, as a Mac person, take the email and drop it into notes? You know, would that accomplish the same thing? Or
I think the idea is like I don't think I would use it at my desktop where I can have a bunch of windows open, but if I'm on I'm on a MacBook Air with a small screen, you know, or I'm on an iPad or on a phone where multiple windows, multiple apps, or it's not as, I mean, iPad's not a good example because you can do the split screen, but
right.
I think, I'm not sure. I wish Pat were here. She could really address it, because this is not one I'm really up on. But one of the things that it does is it keeps the note attached to the email in your email system. So that's a big difference too. So if I get an email from you and I want to make an important note about this email, and I put it in, you know, I archive it, and then I need to refer back to it, I open up the email again, the note I made about it is right there, as opposed to in Apple Notes and another. So that, I think, may be a big reason why that's would be a beneficial. So something to keep in mind. Yeah. So those are a bunch of different tools. There's a couple others that we were going to look at, but I think that, you know, for now, I think given what we've talked about, I think that's a good set of email tools. And we'll come back and revisit email tools in the future, especially if you folks have any questions or suggestions of other tools to look at. And we may also revisit email clients at some point, because there are a lot of different email clients out there that are worth a look, that are, you know, not just the built-in Apple Mail or Outlook or, the various ones like that. It's worth checking out and seeing if they might have features that can help. All right. So with that, let's take a moment right now to thank our patrons and make it possible for us to create the Secrets of Technology, including Robert and Madeline L., Andrea M., Eric A., Cher W., and Father Jeff H. Their generous donations at sqpn.com/give make it possible for us to continue the Secrets of Technology and all the shows at StarQuest. And you can join them by visiting sqpn.com/give. So, Joanne, our first couple of headlines are ones you brought to my attention. So I think we should jump into those. They have to do with the Roku streaming boxes. What's going on with Roku, Joanne?
Oh, this was a good one. Roku apparently has updated their terms of service. And normally when you have a streaming device and they do something like that, it comes up when you, you know, fire it on, and then you have choices. They only gave you one choice, except if you didn't accept it, you couldn't get into your Roku. Let me tell you, it was the talk of the subreddit for the last 3 days.
Wow.
Because people were screaming, people have come up with hacks. Like, if you keep pressing the button, you know, if you keep pressing the X, you can get out of it quickly. You know, they're trying to do all kinds of things. I don't like a company that sells you something.
Yep.
And then changes, it's like changing the horse in the middle of the stream. Either you accept what we want you to do now, and it's some archaic thing about if you want to opt out of it, you have to write a letter to their lawyer.
Right.
So, okay, you're going to leave your screen, Roku screen like this, go find the lawyer's name on the website, write him a letter. You know, it's just so convoluted.
And you can't use your Roku for the days it takes the USPS first class mail to get back and forth.
Right. And it's over some sort of
dispute resolution.
Class action. Yeah, it's a class action thing. They don't want you to. But here's the kicker. So that happened like 3 days ago. Last night or today came out with, now they're disclosing a breach of 15,000 accounts.
Oh.
Right. So what came first, the chicken or the egg?
So in other words, did they find the breach, anticipate a class action lawsuit, and now they're trying to head that off with a mandatory, you accept our terms to not sue us, basically.
Right. Exactly.
Wow.
That's the problem. And they're trying to play this down by saying, well, these 15,000 accounts, it was only because they had used their logins somewhere else. And they were able to find the same login here.
We're using their passwords.
Okay, you know what? That's lame. Because how many people do it?
More people
than I'd like to know. But the whole thing is, you purchase an item. Okay. And yes, there's, you know, you have to click through all of the terms of service. You're giving up your firstborn to Satan or something. And it just, you just say yes, yes, yes to everything. But then to pull something like this and say, you can't use the device. There's no opt out option. There's no, let's talk about this. There's no contact somebody else. And now you can't use the item you bought.
This is bricking the device. But strong arming people to accept a new contract. I mean, in a way, you could say that this has created an invalid contract because you can't force people to sign a contract. You're basically forcing, like, it would be like if I had my phone and Apple pops up a message on my phone saying, by the way, you can't use your phone to make calls or go on the internet, do anything until you accept these new terms of service. Well, I have no choice at that point. Like, I'm being strong-armed.
Exactly. And to me, I have a Roku. I've had a Roku sort of to learn the device and have something as a spare. At work, however, I have 10 Rokus, which my catechists and other groups are using on a regular basis, and a Roku TV. It gets worse when it's a TV. Because now what do? Roku's built into the TV.
Right.
You can't use your TV at all.
Right. Oh, man.
It's becoming a big problem. I hate to see what their stock prices are, what's happening with the stock prices. But this is something to be concerned about. Roku is a solid and good product. And I would hate to see it, you know, some stupid decision on some bean counter or lawyer's part unravel a very good system that people have been using for a very long time.
And it's the sort of thing that we've seen happen. Not exactly this, but where people have bought and paid for a product, and then maybe the company gets sold or the company changes plans, and they brick the product. They just break it so that you can't use it anymore, and people are just stuck. Like, you know, I paid for this, and now you won't let me use it. It just doesn't seem right that. I mean, I get that some products require like servers and things like that to run, and if they can't keep the servers running, that's, you know, oh well. But like in this case, this isn't anything like that. This is, we want, our lawyers want you to accept the new terms of service, a new contract for working with us, and we're going to make you sign it or you can't use this product you bought and paid for. Frankly, I think they should be forced to say, you know, if you don't choose to sign the new terms of service, we'll have to refund your money. They should at least do that.
Yeah, that would be good. And from what I understand, there's a time limit on it, a 30-day time limit that started on February 20th.
To write a letter to opt out.
Right. On the 20th of February, and this came out this week.
Right. So this is, you have basically a week left as the show goes out, basically 6 days to opt out. Yeah, that's ridiculous.
Exactly.
That is crazy.
Yeah, it makes me look at Roku now like, ooh, what did I do? I just, you know, told my churches that this was a really good thing that we could be using. And now we could be having a problem with it. I know I'm not alone because I know lots of companies use Rokus for different things.
It's an inexpensive alternative to, you know, Chromecast and Amazon Fire and Apple TV. I mean, it's a it was the independent, you know, different one who wasn't one of the big three.
And it was, and it's well priced.
Yes.
For what you get.
Right.
So it figures it's the American way.
So
break it.
So yeah, we'll have to follow this and see what happens. Hopefully they'll wise up. So there's another story I want to address. Sort of controversy, and partly this comes up because I've now had several people ask me about this because I'm a well-known Apple fan. But the Daily Mail, I've seen this in different places, but the one here is the UK's Daily Mail. iPhone users in uproar over Apple's new journal app that automatically downloaded to your device and can detect strangers nearby. So in iOS 17, Apple introduced the journal app, and we've talked about this on the show. And what it does is it uses some machine learning to gather information from data that's in your phone, and it stays on your phone, and it suggests journaling apps, journaling entries for you. So if you use it, it'll say, hey, by the way, you went to this place yesterday and you took these photos and you listened to this music. And do you want to write a journal entry about some of these things? And it seems pretty innocuous, but there are some pundits out there. I don't know what bee got in their bonnet, but there was this one in particular on X who wrote, when you write in a digitally powered AI journal, AI is an intermediary layer between your brain and the journal. AI will prompt you with what to write based on reviewing your digital history on your device. The sacred bond between pen and paper and your brain no longer exists. And it's just like, AI prompts you to, this is, the AI prompts is a problem. For example, what if you want to write a journal entry about your new dog, but AI prompts you to reflect on your voting choices? I'm like, if you don't want to write about your choice, write your dog. Well,
yeah, like we both have Day One.
Yes.
Right.
Yes. I've been using Day One for 14 years.
Right. And it comes up with the prompt if you want it to. And it can send you a text message if you want it to, which I did for 4 days and said, no, I can't take it anymore.
Right.
But it's a suggestion.
Exactly.
If you don't have anything to write, or if it comes up and says, what does home mean to you? Well, but I want to write about what happened at work today. It's my choice. I'll write what I want.
Well, here's a couple of things that people keep bringing up. Like, it's collecting all this data. All this data is already on your phone. All the stuff it's suggesting is already there. And Apple is very clear, and nobody has proven that this is otherwise. All of this data stays on your phone. All the AI stuff, the machine language stuff, the algorithm stuff, is in your phone. It is in this article, in fact, tells you that it's in your phone. It doesn't go out from your phone anywhere. It's not sending it to the cloud. It's not doing anything with it. It's not transmitting information about you to anybody. It's just, hey, this is the information that already exists in your phone. You've got photos on your phone, right? You've taken photos,
right?
It's how is that different from having a photos app? Your photos app knows all the places you've been and taken photos. Did you know that? It will tell you all the specific locations. It knows where you live. Well, duh.
Yeah. Well, hello, Apple Maps. When I get in the car in the morning now with my little, Apple CarPlay, it says, you're going to work. Here's the map. Here's the route to your work. And I'm like, okay.
Yeah. My phone knows every place I've ever been.
Of course, because it's been trained. Well, but here's the thing, though, from a writing history perspective. I ascribe to the Hamilton line, you should be the one to tell your own story.
Sure.
So these prompts are lovely. You don't have to listen to them. You write your own story. And if this is something you want to share, fine. And if you want to hit delete the day before you die, you can do that too.
Right.
It's up to you. Why do people think that this is trying to take our minds, our will away from us when we're, I think some people are giving it to the devices rather than, you know, this is my will and I'll do what I want.
I think it's connected to a lot of this fear, uncertainty, doubt around how these devices work. People like to think that they're listening to what I say, that, you know, just the other day I was having a conversation with my spouse about Aruba and suddenly I was getting all kinds of ads for Aruba on Facebook. They're listening and they're not listening. They are observing your the behavior that you're giving them by where you surf and all this sort of stuff because you use Facebook. Like if you use Facebook, you give in Google, you're giving them lots of information. So it's not that they're spying on us. They don't need to spy on us. The other part of this too is there was another element, which is they talk about how the journaling app API detects other Bluetooth devices around you during the day. And they're like, it's detecting other people near you. Yeah, but it doesn't. It says right in it. It knows that there are devices there, but it doesn't know who they are. There is no identifying information about those Bluetooth devices. And you are not giving it any information about yourself to any other devices.
I swear they think it's an instant tracking system. Another, it's like an AirTag. No, the phone, at least the Apple phone, the privacy is there for the phone for as much as you can be private. Okay.
Right.
We're living in a world now. And I think, you know, I have to quote Leo Laporte. If you really want to be private, you know, unplug yourself from everything and go live in a cabin in the woods.
Right.
It's the only way you're going to be truly private. Having said that, there are ways to protect yourself. There's a ways to minimize how much information or tracking gets out. You need to learn where those things live in your phone and use them.
Right. And for people who don't want the journaling API to have this information, the article that we'll link to has very clear instructions on how to turn off all the journaling suggestions and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. I don't use the journal. I, like you said, I have had day one for years, so I don't need it. I tried it out. It was interesting. It was kind of basic. It's not the sort of journaling I do.
You can delete it, right? You can delete it off the phone, right?
Yeah, you can even delete the app if you want.
Well, there you go.
But, you know, in fact, I think a future version of day one, I don't know if you, it might now, can use these same journaling suggestions in day one. Like they can use the same API stuff. I'm not going to record the music I listen to. It's not the way I do things. I mean, maybe someone else wants to do that, but that's not my type of journaling. But you can turn it off. And this is the thing about Apple stuff. Apple's bread and butter is privacy. And I know you can be cynical about that. Like, sure it is. But they've built their business brand on the idea that they're more private than Google and Facebook. And if they were to do anything to undermine that, to disprove that, they would destroy their brand.
Right.
There would be no reason for anyone to trust it. So it is in their best interest to not do something stupid like spy on you. In fact, they were making this idea that there's AI in your phone. That's bad. No, AI model, an AI engine in your phone is 1,000 times better than one in the cloud from a privacy perspective. You want the one in your phone rather than the one in the cloud. Now, from a feature perspective, the one in the cloud is much more powerful. The Google's AI features on their phones, and the Pixels and the Android phones they're ahead of Apple's. They are better. They do a better job like identifying people and that sort of stuff because it's in the cloud.
But they spy on you. They keep your information. They use your information.
Right. All that information is in the cloud and they're using it to advertise to you and that sort of stuff. And that's as long as you go into these things understanding that's what's happening, then that's you're making a decision as an adult to engage in this behavior where there's a transaction. They get information from you and you get the features. If you're okay with that, you know, power to you. That's nothing illegal, immoral, or unethical about any of that, as long as everyone is aware of what's going on. But in this case, right. That's not even what's happening. And, you know, this is, it's a tempest in a teapot, and it's really kind of blows my mind.
It was an alarmist article.
Oh my gosh.
It really was the way it read.
And people who don't understand how the technology works, they read this stuff and there's enough there to make them go, oh my gosh, that's true. This is terrible. Apple is spying on us. And they're not. No, it's not. They're just not.
Yeah.
So, I'm sure listeners will have more questions on this. If you do, you know, we're happy to address them in a future episode. Send them in technology@sqpn.com and we'll address this more. Our next headline is one. I like this one because I've a personal experience. The article from Scientific American, the headline is "Making Alarms More Musical Can Save Lives." And they're talking about specifically medical alarms. Anyone who's ever been in a hospital for any length of time, whether you're yourself or visiting someone, my wife has had 5 babies in hospitals, so I spent a lot of time there, and elderly parents who've been in hospitals, you know that this constant, like, if there's one thing you can count on being in a hospital is the constant beeping. Something somewhere is always beeping. And they talk about alarm fatigue and how people just get immune to hearing alarms. And so the scientists studied the sounds and came up with the suggestions for other sounds that are better for helping us to pay attention to them, and that we should be differentiating sounds between the different devices depending on how important they are. Percussive timbres like wine glasses clinking for important alarms, loud flat tones that lack high frequency, like a reversing truck's beep, 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 beep. That's for less important sounds. They kind of fade into the background. What do you think, Joanne? Have you had the experience of dealing with hospital alarms?
Yes, I have. And as a musician, I will just make one correction. It's called timbres.
Sorry.
Okay. That's okay. It's a musical term.
It looks like timbre, but it's timbre. Yes.
It does look like timbre, but it's timbre. I learned that early on. But a timbre is a tone quality. Okay. So you can have the same note sounding, but different timbres and overtones will give it a different quality of sound. So even if you're doing a pitch of A, for example, the best way to say is on a flute, it sounds one way. On a clarinet, it sounds more woody. On a, on a piano, it sounds more percussive. So what they're saying is even if you have to use the different sounds to kind of shape them in a way that one will call your attention to one device, another one will call your attention to another device. So it doesn't even have to be high or low. It's just the change in the quality of the sound. I thought it was quite interesting.
Yeah.
And I think some of us already have got, when we hear certain sounds in the real world, we know what a truck backing up sounds like.
Right.
Okay. Our forefathers would have known what a train whistle sound like. You know,
and it meant a train whistle. Yeah.
Right. But when you go into a hospital, every single one of those darn machines sounds exactly the same.
Yeah. And I don't know that even the people who work there can tell the difference.
No. And I have nurse friends who cannot.
Yeah.
So everything is bing, bong, bing, bong. And half the time they go tone deaf.
Yeah.
Because they don't want to deal with it. This was a very good article. Brings up a really good,
It references but doesn't address a related issue, which is alarm fatigue, which is when you hear the same, no matter how good an alarm, how different alarm is, if you hear the same alarm all the time, the same sound all the time, you start to tune it out. You don't even hear it anymore. Like when you hear a car alarm, do you even look anymore? I just assume
I
just assume, unless it's my car, I just assume that it's somebody, accidentally set off their car alarm, like a neighbor. I'm not going to run out to make sure there's no one stealing my neighbor's car because they happen so often that I don't even bother anymore.
But even car horns are different. I mean, I just changed cars. I mean, they're two different Subarus, two different years, but my old car horn sounds different than my new car. My new car horn sounds a little wimpy. Sorry. but Even my ringtones, I have separate ringtones for people.
Oh, I do too.
That I've associated with them so that I know whether to hurry up and answer that or that one can go. And then I have the default ring and that's for everybody else. And I know to just ignore that.
Right. Melanie is on U2's Beautiful Day.
Okay.
My dad was La Donna Immobile.
Donna
Mobile.
And that
makes me sad because I'm never going to hear that anymore, you know, because my dad's
gone. I'll be on total disclosure here. My mother's was Copacabana.
Nice.
So every time she called it. Exactly. Nice. But these type of things make you. Uh-huh. React a certain way. So if we bring that into a hospital setting or a nursing home setting and do the same thing where something that's telling them that somebody's breathing is now being cut off sounds different than the saline solution going into somebody else's arm.
Yep.
It's two different responses. It should be two different responses. Yeah.
The beep of the IV machine, like that constant beep that, like I remember Melanie trying to sleep after having, C-section, and the beep it's irregular. It's not constant and it's irregular enough that it just could keep you awake. Right. I remember trying to sleep in the room with her and it's like, and it's like, why does it have to beep?
People don't realize how much music or how much sound affects them. In certain ways. Yes. And without it, or too much of the same thing can disaffect you as well as affect you. People don't give music enough credit.
We've got an episode of The Secrets of Doctor Who coming up. It should be out in a couple of weeks, I think. We've already recorded it, called Scherzo. It has to do with, it's an audio story, and it has to do with a sound and a creature made of sound. And an alternate universe sort of thing. And it's very much there's the whole thing about how, the king banned music from his kingdom. And then what that did, how it broke everything when music was gone, because everything is musical, even our heartbeats, even the waves, even the, everything is music. And, and that's what kind of reminded me of. If folks are interested in that, it was a really great discussion Father Corey and I had about that story. It was called Scherzo. Should be out in a couple of weeks, I think, on The Secrets of Doctor Who. So, all right. So let's move on to our final headline. And it's an Apple headline, but really this applies to all electronic devices. The headline is Apple officially warns users to stop putting wet iPhones in rice. And this is a thing that been common advice for years that when your little electronics get wet, you should put it in a bowl of rice and let it sit, because rice is dry. And we know that rice absorbs liquid when we cook it. And so what would be better? I had a Taiwanese American friend priest who said that we put our phone in rice to attract Asian technologists to come fix our devices. He was Taiwanese, so he could say that. But they said, stop doing this because rice, like commercial rice, isn't just a bunch of grains in a bag. It's like, if you've ever noticed, your rice is dusty. They actually, they not only is it covered in starch, but they actually coat a lot of commercial rice is coated in vitamin D. I don't know if you know that. So that's why I don't rinse my regular long grain rice. For short grain rices, now we're in the cooking segment. Short grain rices like jasmine and basmati. I rinse those. But for regular rice, like long grain Carolina rice, that sort of stuff, I don't rinse it because I don't want to wash off the vitamin. But there's also like hulls and broken bits of rice and all this sort of stuff. And so they're like all that dust and stuff can get into your phone if you've submerged it in a bowl of rice. So and it doesn't actually work. It doesn't work any better than just leaving your phone to sit on the counter.
Well, but all these people have done it for years.
Yeah.
And then the other hack, I believe, is those silicone packs.
So I save the desiccant packs.
So do I.
From when I get packages, and I put them in a Ziploc bag so that they don't absorb the humidity of the regular atmosphere. And then that way, if I get a device gets wet, I can throw it into the bag with those. Don't eat the packs, remember. But you throw it in the bag, and that's a desiccant that'll help as well. But they, in general, what they're talking about is if you get that warning, if you plug a cable into a phone, it might pop up a warning saying, we've detected moisture inside, unplug it. So just unplug it, set it aside, and just, put it in a place with it moving air. Maybe you could blow cold air on it, but don't use a hairdryer and like that. I mean, in general, iPhones are generally pretty waterproof. Most decent phones out there that you're paying more than a couple hundred bucks for are generally going to be pretty waterproof these days. But if you got a problem, take it to the store. I mean, at this point.
Hey, Apple, why don't you put into the phone what is into the watch? The little dryer.
Yeah, that would be interesting. I wonder if it could work.
Yeah.
So on the watch, it uses a ultrasonic to vibrate any moisture out of the little speaker grill, which is the only opening on the watch. It's a tiny little speaker.
Right.
And that's the only opening. But there's a lot more openings on a phone. There's like the port and the speakers. I don't know. Could they do it?
I bet you could still do it.
Well, Apple wants to
Apple.
Yeah, Apple wants to get rid of the port anyway, so that may become a moot point.
Don't do that, because I have a wired CarPlay.
That's probably why they haven't done it yet. Yeah, that's why they haven't done it yet. But the bottom line is don't plunge your phone, your devices of whatever stripe, make into rice. That's probably a bad idea.
And take the phone out of your pocket before you go to the bathroom. Because yes. That's where most people have a problem.
Without revealing too much, I don't like smacking my phone against porcelain and stuff or the floor or whatever. I always take my phone out of my pocket whenever I'm in the bathroom. TMI, I know. Nobody wants to imagine
I won't
that.
Tell you about my friends anyway.
So, let's at this point move on quickly to our picks of the week. And Joanne, why don't you go first? What's your pick this week?
My pick, because I listened to last week's episode, was something y'all forgot when you were talking about photos and where to store them. And you don't want to store them in like a commercial company, and you may not want to put them in the iCloud. Those of you who own the Synology network attached storage systems, there is now a system or an app called Synology Photos. And it will set itself up on your Synology NAS as a repository. You put the app on your other devices and it will take them all in as you take pictures. It will also suck all the pictures out of your Macs. Mm-hmm. And I only have experience in the Mac, so it probably does it for the Windows as well.
Yes.
But, and I've been starting to use it, and it's, its AI facial features are pretty good. It does animals, so it will distinguish between your dog and your cat. But I kind of like it. I wanted a place where I could put everything, because I have some in Amazon, some in the cloud, got the rest out of Google. But I wanted one place that was near, that was here in the house, just in case the other two go down. And it was free. It comes with the Synology package.
You've already paid for it. Yeah.
Yep. So give it a shot if you're looking for that type of system.
Yeah. It is cross-platform, and it installs on your phone, Android or iOS, which is great. And so it will take your photos as you take them, automatically put them into the Synology system. The app looks like iPhoto and Google, Photos.
Yes, so it does.
You'll be familiar with it.
It looks a little more like Melio. It's a little more on that one.
Okay. Yeah.
I have a little bit of experience with that. It looks a little bit more like Melio, but
okay.
I like the way it initially sets things up, and now I'm starting to play with it as far as making different albums and all that kind of stuff.
Now, the one thing that caveat to hear is your photos are only going to be on your NAS. So if something happens to your NAS, something happens to your house, you lose your photos. So you've got to make sure you're backing that up somewhere else as well. Offsite.
3-2-1
3-2-1 Yep. So, like I said, I back up my NASs to the cloud. I use Amazon's Glacier to back up my, my NAS. And actually I also have a local backup as well. I have a hard drive that sits next to the NAS that backs it up as well. And that wasn't the easy. It could be easier to set those up. I would admit, Synology is great, but maybe we could do a episode where we talk about Synology. I don't have experience with any of the other NASs. I've just Synology is the one I love.
Me too. It's same here.
Used it for years, and I've always settled on it. Yeah, you're right. Synology Photos is another alternative that. If you could do it, with alongside iPhoto or Google Photo and Amazon Photo too. Yeah.
I would never suggest it to be the only solution for your photos. It needs to be one of a few different solutions because things can get lost anywhere.
Yes. Yep. So,
or Roku could put a disclaimer on it and you can't get your photos either.
Right. Right. So my pick this week is a little offbeat, a little unexpected. So I found this article this blog by Jay Summers. It says that you're probably using the wrong dictionary. And it's an interesting article about what the purpose of dictionaries, what dictionaries used to be for. And they weren't just there to give you bland definitions of words. That they used to be ways to help you think and write, to give you to punch up your language, really. The article goes into the blog post goes into some detail about how, like, a famous American writer like John McPhee used the dictionary to do more than just define a word or even get synonyms, but to really provide imagery and poetry and art to his words. He talks about writing about taking a canoe, and when you look up a canoe in the dictionary, it just means it's a canoe or canoeing. A modern dictionary would call it a water sport that involves a boat of some sort. You know what I mean? Whereas an older dictionary, a diversion of the field is one of the definitions. He's like, oh, and so he incorporated that into a story he was writing about taking a canoe trip in the wilderness, and how it was a diversion of the field, an act performed not because it is necessary, but because there is value in the act itself. And that's much more poetic than saying, oh, it's a sport. So that said, the writer of this blog post, James Summers, it's jsummers.net, but James Summers suggested that people use an older dictionary, and specifically Webster's 1913 dictionary, which is he says the closest thing you can get to a plain text, easily hackable, free out of copyright version of the dictionary that McPhee would probably have used. So it adheres to these sort of standards, and it's available in an open source format, a text format. And his article on the blog post even tells you how to install Webster's 1913 dictionary on your Mac, iPhone, Android, and Kindle. He doesn't go into Windows. I'm not sure. There's probably a way to do it in Windows. If you Googled it, there's probably instructions online for how to do it on Windows. Now, the original blog post is from 2014. So the iOS instructions the macOS instructions are no longer valid. So there's another article I will link that gives the updated instructions for how to install it on your Mac if you choose. And so what happens is once you do that, when you use the built-in functionality, like you highlight a word and it pops up, you know, there's a key combination, I forget what it exactly is, to look up a word, or you go to under the edit menu and you look up word spelling and grammar, or where does it do that? I forget where it does it, under the menu. So anyway, when you use the built-in dictionary, there's a dictionary app on your Mac. It will use the Webster's 1913 dictionary definitions of for it. As a, in fact, I have a new Mac and I just realized I didn't install this yet, so I need to go through and reinstall this on my new Mac. So because I just opened it up, I'm like, wait a minute, that's not the good dictionary. In any case, it's fun. If you're a word nerd, if you like words, it's a nice throwback. It's fun. It's kind of fun to take a 21st century tool and install this early 20th century tool on it and make it work. There's even a web version of Webster's 1913 at Webster's1913.com where you can go and look up words there and get the older version of it. So
that sounds cool.
Yeah, it's fun. I even put it on my Kindle. It's kind of fun to, you know, as I'm reading, looking up words on my Kindle, you know, and getting the older definitions. All right. So that does it for us this time. We'd like to take a moment now. I already thanked our patrons. Thank you again. Now is when I ask all of you listening to let us know what you think of our discussion or anything we've talked about this time. You can do so by commenting on the show at sqpn.com/technology or the StarQuest Facebook page at facebook.com/StarQuestMedia, or send an email to technology@sqpn.com. Or visit the StarQuest Discord community at sqpn.com/discord. You'll find links from our discussion and our picks of the week on our show notes at starquest.fm/TEC248. Remember to like each episode of Secrets of Tech on our Facebook page, retweet them on X, where we're at SQPN, and leave us comments wherever you find us. We love to hear from you. Until next time, Joanne Mercier, thank you for joining me in sharing the secrets of technology.
Thanks, Dom.
And once again, I'm Dom Bettinelli. Thank you for listening to The Secrets of Technology on StarQuest.